From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Lewis Katz.
This week on War News Radio, Stateside, we first hear about the Boeing Company and its defense contracts.
Then, we look at coverage of the recent veterans' rape scandal.
Finally, we talk with author and professor Richard Sobel about changing public opinion regarding the U.S.'s involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
People across Iraq took to the streets this week on Valentine's Day in a call for jobs, basic utilities, and an end to government corruption. Infrastructure in the country has seen gradual but small improvement since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion, and access to services remains a problem for many Iraqis. The protests follow a number of widespread revolts in the Middle East, including those in Egypt and Tunisia. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has stated that he welcomes the protests, but claims greater quality of life will come with greater oil production. While this week's protests were relatively scattered, a large national action is scheduled for February 25th and is being promoted through various social media sites.
Iraqi security forces opened fire on a group of protesters outside a provincial governor's office in the eastern city of Kut, killing at least 3 people. Following the shooting, the protesters set the governor's office and home on fire. Dozens of security forces and protesters were injured in the ensuing violence, making this the bloodiest incident since Iraqis began taking to the street. Despite a curfew, the protesters promised to continue with the protests.
Shiite pilgrims traveling by bus to the Al-Askari Mosque were killed when a suicide bomber detonated his vest. The attack occurred in Samarra, north of Baghdad, leaving 64 injured and at least 36 dead. This is the second attack on pilgrims traveling to Al-Askari in recent weeks. Al-Askari, one of Iraq's holiest Shiite shrines, has historically been a target for violence against Iraq's Shiite majority. Groups linked to Al-Qaeda bombed the Shiite shrine in 2006 and 2007, setting off a wave of retaliatory violence against Sunni clerics and mosques.
U.S. officials have demanded that Pakistan release Raymond Davis, a U.S. citizen who claims he shot 2 armed Pakistani men in self-defense. The officials state that he should be covered under diplomatic immunity, as he is an employee of the U.S. government. The U.S. recently postponed annual high-level talks with Pakistan and Afghanistan to pressure for Davis's release. Amidst public outcry over the shooting, Pakistan has been unwilling to release Davis, stating that the matter must be decided in Pakistan's local courts. President Obama dispatched Senator John Kerry to Pakistan, fearing that the incident may establish a precedent for trying American officials in foreign courts.
President Obama's proposed 2012 budget for the Department of Defense will achieve the first decrease in total defense spending since September 11th. The decrease depends upon a successful drawdown of U.S. troops from Iraq. The proposed budget anticipates 2012 military spending levels at $671 billion. Republican leaders have argued for significantly higher cuts to the defense budget, but military officials state that more cuts could be devastating. Obama has also advocated for increased funding for State Department diplomacy and development programs. In addition, Obama's budget includes a new category, Overseas Contingency Operations, which is devoted to special funding for Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan.
Earlier this week, a suicide bombing killed 2 Afghan civilians in downtown Kabul. The attack took place near a hotel and shopping complex popular with foreigners and is the second major bombing in Kabul this month. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for both attacks. This recent increase in violence in the Afghan capital discredits government claims of Kabul's relative security as a sign of the country's progress.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is expected to name retired diplomat Mark Grossman as the new U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. He would replace Richard Holbrook, who passed away last year. Grossman previously worked in the U.S. Embassy in Pakistan in the 1970s, and was the U.S. ambassador to Turkey in the 1990s.
U.S. officials have demanded that Pakistan release Raymond Davis, a U.S. citizen who claims he shot two armed Pakistani men in self-defense. The officials state that he should be covered under diplomatic immunity, as he is an employee of the U.S. government. The U.S. recently postponed annual high-level talks with Pakistan and Afghanistan to pressure for Davis's release. Amidst public outcry over the shooting, Pakistan has been unwilling to release Davis, stating that the matter must be decided in Pakistan's local courts. President Obama dispatched Senator John Kerry to Pakistan, fearing that the incident may establish a precedent for trying American officials in foreign courts.
The Times of London recently reported that General David Petraeus would be stepping down as chief of U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan by the end of this year. Pentagon officials have strongly denied the Times' claim and stated that there is no plan in place for Petraeus' departure. Petraeus himself has expressed a commitment to keeping his position until the Afghan war's conclusion. U.S. forces are scheduled to begin a pullout from Afghanistan this July, but Petraeus is expected to request that as many troops as possible remain in order to ensure Afghan stability. This is War News Radio. Thousands of people fly back and forth in the Boeing company's commercial airliners every day. What these thousands may not know is that the Pentagon spends billions of dollars on government contracts with Boeing. The company provides the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, U.S. allies, and more with products and services that couldn't be farther from those found at your local airport. Kate Aronoff has the story.
According to their corporate website, Boeing is the world's leading aerospace company and the largest manufacturer of commercial jetliners and military aircraft combined. They pride themselves on being a global corporate citizen. Dan Beck is Director of External Communications for Boeing's Defense, Space, and Security Division.
The things that Boeing has produced over the decades have opened up the world to people from all walks of life. So we do feel a great responsibility as a global company. We also feel a great responsibility, and we have an interest in making sure that we're doing the right things.
The Boeing Company is the third largest defense contractor in the United States, according to a study done by Washington Technology, a government contract trade magazine. The company itself reports that just under half of their revenue comes from government contracts. OpenSecrets.org, a lobbying watchdog group, reports that they were the top lobbyists last year from the aerospace defense industry, spending millions of dollars on Capitol Hill. Boeing continues to have a large presence both in the U.S. government and in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, contracting on everything from logistics to unmanned drones. Boeing has a long history of defense contracting, dating almost all the way back to its 1916 founding. The company began providing training seaplanes to the United States Navy in World War I and has continued to expand its involvement in conflicts since. Today, within the U.S. government, Boeing sells mainly to the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security. Dan Beck talks about this history.
Since the 1920s, the company has fulfilled military contracts, mostly for aircraft. And over time, in addition to growing as a commercial aircraft manufacturer, we have also provided military aircraft and other systems for U.S. and international customers right on through the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam, and all of the conflicts leading up to Iraq and Afghanistan.
A large part of Boeing's defense projects involve aircraft. The company also provides the government with a wide variety of products and services, including training and satellite surveillance. Joseph DiNardi is an associate analyst at Stifel Nicolaus & Company, a firm which provides investment recommendations and market research for Boeing and other large-scale defense contractors.
The defense business consists of three separate units. They have a military aircraft division, so that they would make aircraft like the F-18, the C-17, you know, the tanker that they're currently competing in the tanker competition for, and then a couple of helicopter programs. Then they maintain a space division where they mean, you know, they make satellites for the DoD and NSA, and then they have a services division where they would provide you know, like logistics work for troops overseas or maintenance work for aircraft domestically.
Overall, the company consists of five divisions: Boeing Commercial Airplanes, Boeing Capital Corporation, Engineering, Operations, and Technology, a shared services group, and Boeing Defense, Space, and Security, otherwise known as BDS. This division, serving the United States as well as other governments and commercial buyers, accounted for 49% of the company's total revenue in 2010, amounting to well over $8 billion. Boeing is currently competing with an Airbus affiliate for a roughly $35 billion contract to provide the U.S. Air Force with a new tanker aircraft. This nearly decade-long dispute has been a contentious one for Boeing. The competition was postponed in 2003 when Darlene Droyan pled guilty in front of U.S. District Court of inflating the price of the contract. The controversy, which CBS News called the biggest Pentagon scandal in 20 years, was followed by the resignation of CEO Philip Condon and the termination of CFO Michael Sears. Despite these and other controversies, the U.S. government continues to spend billions of dollars in contracts and subsidies on the company. In December, the Department of Defense awarded Boeing an additional $10 million on top of a previous agreement. The Pentagon's proposed $671 billion 2012 budget could give the company a significant boost in government funding. The company may receive $54 billion in manned and unmanned aircraft procurement and research and development funding, 27% of the budget's allotment for all procurement and R&D work. As a means of securing its extensive government and commercial interests, Boeing spends a considerable amount of time and money on Capitol Hill, where it has lobbied on an array of legislation through the Boeing Political Action Committee, or BPAC. Boeing's website describes the committee as a voluntary, nonpartisan political action committee established by the Boeing Company in accordance with federal law. Last year, the company spent $18 million lobbying on issues from aviation and education to foreign relations and homeland security. Dave Leventhal is editor of OpenSecrets.org, a nonpartisan group which monitors lobbying efforts in Washington.
You look at all of all the different companies within the defense aerospace industry in particular, which is the industry that we classify the Boeing Company in. They are number one as a defense contractor. It often pays to have a very strong and robust lobbying force because it allows you to really address a number of issues. It allows you to address a number of members of Congress and people in federal agencies and really have yourself represented to them on a variety of issues that you care about.
Boeing's involvement with the government, though, has not been limited to its lobbying and recruitment efforts. The company meets with government officials to ensure the development and distribution of their products and services. Dan Beck talks about this relationship.
So one thing that we're seeing now is more of a dialogue, more of an outreach on the part of the Defense Department to assess what the needs of the defense industrial base. There are large meetings with industry. It really is that kind of an exchange.
The New York Times last month reported on a leaked cable which revealed that U.S. diplomats had been acting as salespeople for the company's commercial airliners overseas. According to the NewYorkTimes.com, hundreds of leaked cables reveal a close relationship between the company and prominent government officials. In January, the World Trade Organization ruled that the company had received at least $5 billion in illegal subsidies from federal and local governments in the United States, according to the SeattleTimes.com. Joe DiNardi speaks to Boeing's investment approach.
For the most part, the management teams make their decision probably similarly to how they would make a decision that wasn't related to wartime activities, you know, whether it's going to provide a good return on investment. You know, I don't think that they look at whether the contract is associated with
The Boeing Company makes its investments, like all companies, with a cost-benefit analysis. Whether they're producing commercial airliners or unmanned drones, Boeing's ultimate goal is to make a profit. For War News Radio, I'm Kate Aronoff.
This is War News Radio. This week, a group of U.S. veterans who say that they were raped or sexually assaulted while serving are suing the Pentagon, demanding reform in how situations like their own are handled. Aaron Moser takes a look at how this controversial event is being covered in the media.
NBC reports that women serving in the U.S. military are more likely to be raped by a fellow soldier than shot by enemy fire. Sexual assault has been a serious problem in the U.S. military for some time. Now, a group of 15 current and former service members, 13 women and 2 men, are suing the Pentagon, claiming that the institution has ignored reports of sexual crimes within the military. Their class action lawsuit names Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and his predecessor, Donald Rumsfeld, demanding reform in the process of handling claims of sexual crimes. A music video posted on www.sexualassault.army.mil suggests that the Army is actively fighting sexual assault within its ranks.
Turn the other cheek is a thing of the past. Up close and real when they try to harass. Don't let a bad situation ever go unchecked. Soldiers help the soldiers, let the message connect. I'm strong worldwide, we defend and protect. Let them know that we here, we demand respect. When they dare in the dark and the predator persists, step up in his face, you can tell them this.
In 2004, the Pentagon created the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Office in an attempt to address the issue. Yet, according to Pentagon statistics, there were over 3,200 reported sexual crimes within the military in 2009. Pentagon numbers also suggest that 80% of such cases go unreported, and that of those that are reported, only 25% are ever prosecuted. Anu Bugwati, the executive director of Service Women's Action Network, tells CNN that although the Department of Defense claims to have addressed the issue, little change has come.
DOD has had decades to prove, to fix the system, and they've proven that they can't. They haven't done anything to change it so far. That culture of intimidation prevails.
Many victims report that instead of receiving support from the military, they were urged to keep quiet and continue with their regular business. Former Marine Sarah Albertson tells her story to NBC. After reporting being violated by a superior, Sarah was instructed to return to work in the same office with her transgressor.
I was told I just needed to suck it up until the end of the investigation and to continue treating him with the respect his rank deserves.
But who told you to suck it up?
All of them. That was just the general attitude.
How
the specific
did they put it?
Words were, Marines don't cry.
The lawsuit argues that corruption in handling reports of rape is widespread. It is not confined to certain units or factions, and this CNN clip seems to reinforce the idea that there is no safe third party to handle these claims.
Myla Hyder says she was raped while serving in Korea with the Army's Criminal Investigation Division, the very unit charged with investigating rapes and assaults.
The people who commit these offenses are sexual predators who are very good at selecting their victims and tend to offend again and again, and that is a fact that is not recognized within the DOD system.
The veterans are demanding that a third party be present to help handle criminal charges of sexual assault. Employers never handle such charges internally, and victims are demanding that the military cannot either. Press TV reported a victim's request.
They should let the courts decide who's telling the truth and who's not, and there should actually be justice done for this instead of just the command saying that they don't want it being published under their command that a rape has occurred, so they just sweep it under a rug.
Although courts may offer a way to deal with future cases, there is some doubt about the destiny of this lawsuit. The Young Turks, a political talk show distributed on the web, discussed the viability of this suit.
They might not win this class action lawsuit at all. Lawyers are saying that it's extremely difficult to prove these incidents. They're saying that it's difficult to even consider this a class action lawsuit because it's hard to prove that this is a systematic thing.
Right. See, but when you see numbers going up by 24%, you begin to believe that it's systematic.
Right.
And they got to at least have a chance to prove that, right? And it makes their cases so much harder if they have to go one by one and they have to go back many years. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so important to have enforcement from the get-go.
Regardless of the end result, this suit has gotten the Department of Defense's attention. The Pentagon released a statement saying, "This is now a command priority, but we still clearly have more to do." Kay Whitley, the director of the Pentagon's Sexual Assault Office, told NBC that although success will not be achieved overnight, they are working to solve this problem.
The research tells us that it takes 8 to 10 years to change a culture. If there are any victims out there that are not getting the care and the help they need, that's what I'm here for. Someone needs to let me know, and they need to give me the details so that I can help them.
The veterans behind the suit are not satisfied with her progress thus far. However, Bhagwati told CNN that she believes there is hope.
Are you confident that we will see change now that it's being talked about more on a national level?
Absolutely. If we keep the pressure on policymakers and on the Department of Defense, they can't get away with this climate anymore.
Media coverage could play a large role in pressuring the Pentagon on this issue. For War News Radio, I'm Aaron Moser.
Intervene, act, motivate. Intervene, act, motivate. We come on. We stand, we fight. Intervene, that's right. When they try to harass, don't let a bad situation ever go unchecked. Soldiers help us, soldiers, let the message connect. I'm strong worldwide, we defend and protect. Let them know that we here, we demand respect. When they dare in the dark and the predator persists, step up in his face, you can tell him this. We stand, we fight, intervene.
This is War News Radio. A recent poll from Quinnipiac University found that for the first time since the U.S. began its military involvement in Afghanistan, a majority of Americans oppose military involvement in the country. Another recent poll from CNN found that 66% of Americans oppose U.S. involvement in Iraq. But what exactly is the impact of public opinion on U.S. foreign policy? Professor Richard Sobel is a public opinion expert at Northwestern University, whose forthcoming book, Public Opinion and International Intervention, Lessons from the Iraq War, addresses these and related questions.
Almost every day a new poll comes out documenting how the public feels about a variety of issues, from presidential popularity to support for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But as Professor Richard Sobel, a public opinion expert, explains, a lot of the time, people just don't understand what this data can tell us.
You know, people are sort of fascinated by public opinion polling and media, and quite often have impressions of how the public feels or the public affects foreign policy and how the media affects foreign policy that are not necessarily what scholars find out.
Sobel says that public support for war is an important factor in the decisions politicians make about whether to intervene in a conflict, end a military operation, or continue it. But he stresses that public opinion isn't as limiting as some might think.
Public opinion doesn't dictate policy. It sets sort of ranges within which policymakers can respond or not respond to public opinion with more or less political costs. And quite often the media will present public opinion, but quite often the media will misrepresent public opinion.
Sobel says that although there is no exact threshold of public support which allows politicians to go to war, it is clear that a majority is not required.
You don't need majority support for an intervention for politicians to be able to intervene with more or less political costs. There are sort of threshold levels. There's nothing precise. It depends upon the conflict. But usually around 40% support is enough to continue an intervention and maybe even sometimes intervene.
Reflecting on the popularity of the Iraq War, Sobel pointed out that often people forget how favorable public sentiment was.
I think a lot of people have forgotten how much support there was for the Iraq War at the start. In the United States, it was, you know, around two-thirds. Even in some of the European countries, it was the only one that sort of rivaled the United States, interestingly, was Australia. But Australia had public opinion of over 50%, and they decided, their government decided to get involved. There were three or four other countries, including the United Kingdom and Canada, where support was in the mid-40s for the war.
The surges in Iraq and Afghanistan provide an interesting case of how public support for a war can change due to policy decision.
One of the most interesting aspects of public support for both Iraq and Afghanistan has been that both of the surges, the first one in Iraq and the second one, the more recent one by the first one by President Bush and the second one by President Obama, the public support actually rose after the decisions and the actual surges because, I would posit, because people thought the likelihood of success had increased and therefore their willingness to support the war was sustained, at least for a time.
As Sobel says, it is important to realize that public opinion constrains but does not set foreign policy. As military operations in Iraq draw down and the war in Afghanistan goes on, this lesson offers an important frame to understand U.S. foreign policy decisions. For War News Radio, I'm Kyle Crawford.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Sam Hirschman, Eliana Biscard Church, Anjali Kadambi, Rosanna Kim, Robert Holika, Jared Nolan, Chloe Wittenberg, Amandine Lee, Colin Smith, John McMinn, Alan Zhao, and John Kwan. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Lewis Katz. Until next time, thanks for listening.